Lulav, what queer and or Jewish things have you been up to recently?
I had my first Rosh Hashanah service. Ooh. Like, in a proper shul. Yeah, I went to Shir Tikva's Rosh Hashanah service. The shofar blasts were a little underwhelming, but
aww,
that's okay. We were in, like, the gymnasium of a Catholic church. A cool Catholic church, which I do not say lightly.
There are cool Catholic churches.
There's one.
I'm sorry. The Vatican has a beautiful Sistine Chapel.
No, that's one of the incredibly vile Catholic churches, unfortunately. Mm. I don't know if there's an actual congregation there.
I don't either. I know actually very little about Christianity. So.
Oh, right. I'm the Christianity expert. That's sad. Or good. Who knows? So yeah, I had a good Rosh Hashanah. And I'm going to do Tashlich in 2 days with the local queer Jewish organization.
Beautiful.
What about you, Jazz?
So I've been teaching about the holiday to children.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, that's been great. This is just a fun story. Yesterday, 7th graders came in and I was chatting with some 7th graders and one of my coworkers. And we were helping 7th graders with their homework. And I don't know anything about math homework. I was never a great math student anyway.
Oh, no.
And one of my coworkers said, you know, I wish I could just spend 2 hours doing homework. And I was like, nerd? What? And he said, oh, like, as if you're not the same way. And I came back to that today when I was like, well, I wish I had more time to just, like, spend really digging into these texts and pull out 3 different translations and look up all the Hebrew words and do other things. And I was like, well, guilty as charged. I also want to voluntarily spend my time doing homework.
Good. It's just you do humanities homework and not maths.
Right. No part of me was like, I'm really excited about the math that this 7th grader was really excited about. I was very excited that he was so excited about it.
Good.
Yeah.
That's the way to be.
So, want to dive right into our episode?
I would love to.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least 2 Jews and generally more than 3 opinions. Each week, we bring you queer takes on Torah. They're Jazz.
And she's Lulav.
And today we're going to talk about Noach.
Great. So I know you have a summary, but I just wanted to insert really quickly because I have thoughts and opinions slash remembered a thing about the Parsha names. And I thought it'd be a cool thing, which is each of the Parsha is named usually with the first word. Like, I was thinking about it because I was like, really? This one is called Noach? That seems like just a very good descriptive name for a Parsha. Like, there is one in the end of Deuteronomy that's Vayelech, which is just, and he went. Like, it's not a very helpful descriptive name. It just happens to be the first word. But Noach is, like, actually a very helpful name. But it's not the first word, like they usually are. It's
okay.
The third word, but it's the first descriptive word, because the first word is Ele, and that's kind of like these or this or whatever. So whoever named them is like, well, this is the first unique word, the first descriptive word, which
yeah,
is great. And I also appreciate it because it feels like how libraries work and also how I organize my podcasts, which is like my podcast feed automatically puts anything that has the under T, and I have sort of manually moved them so it does not do that.
Baruch Hashem.
Yeah. So I appreciate that whoever named the parsha thought like me.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of the whole thing with how saying sick or thus changed into just being like see or yes in romantic languages. And so the equivalent of naming this passage elle would have been like yes.
Okay, now that I've digressed us on a completely different way, would you like to summarize what actually happens in this parsha?
Sure thing.
Our very quick summary that I can give you 20 seconds for.
Oh, God. Before our real one. Can we go with 30?
Yeah, we can go with 30 seconds.
Okay, so real quickly before I say this, I had a really weird night.
Okay.
And subsequent weird morning.
Okay.
And so I like properly woke up pretty much right before the recording. And as a result, I have only deep read through half of this. So this summary is going to be half, I know exactly what I'm doing. And then half like, oh, okay, quickly scan.
Great. It'll be an adventure for all of us.
Yes.
Ready? Go.
So the Lord is like, woo, time to blot out the earth because it's bad, actually. And then he's like, hey, Noah, here are some instructions for building an ark. Noah does that. God does that. And then things start to dry up. And then they redo kind of a covenant thing. And it's like, hey, the ground is dry. Go be fruitful and multiply. There's some animal sacrifice. The prohibitions of murder, and nudity.
Done. Did you hear that timer by any chance?
I very much did.
Great, great, okay.
The good news is the rest of it looks kind of like, oh, no, there's some babble. Why are there so many stories here?
There's a lot of stories happening here. You were going to say that the rest of it is like
genealogies.
Yeah, which there is a bunch of genealogies, and then there's the Tower of Babel. There's a lot happening in this parsha.
Yeah, I guess that's how we tell the passage of time in ancient Jewish literature, is just like, yeah, some people had kids, and then they had kids. And then this one thing happened, but back to the kids.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to do our longer summary? And I will interrupt with questions.
I would love to. Now I get to pull up the notes that I actually read.
Great.
Writ.
You did.
Ooh.
Very, very formally.
It's a weird one.
Yeah.
So it starts off by being like, Noah was pretty cool compared to his contemporaries. He walked with God and he had three sons. Do you have any questions about this, Jazz?
So I know that there is a big argument, and I don't know if this is an argument that's all that interesting to me, but I know that there is a huge rabbinic argument that we could talk about that is this thing of like, is he righteous and a good dude compared to the other people around him?
Mm-hmm.
By which standard, like, he's not a good dude compared to if he was in another generation that was generally better, or is he like good for all time?
So from my personal perspective, I don't think there is such a thing as like upstandingly righteous compared to everything else ever. You can make comparisons of like, hey, this person is better than their contemporaries, but like we're all striving for ultimate goodness, but there is no ultimate goodness. We're just trying to be better.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense to me, but I also have things about like when we talk about it's being subjective and stuff, sometimes you get people who say, oh, but those people who committed horrible atrocities or whatever, it was how things were at the time. And I'm like, well, but they didn't have to do horrible atrocities. Not everybody at that time did horrible atrocities.
Yeah, turns out there were people against slavery in the 1800s
right.
And earlier.
Right.
So, like, when I say that there is no, like, objective standard of goodness, I don't mean that we can't compare other times to our time, because we super can. It's just that, like, middle path. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Let's keep going.
Let's keep. Oh, actually, one other thing that I wanted to mention. It specifically says that Noah walked with God, and we have that a couple chapters earlier when Enoch walks with God, and that may have meant that he died early.
Well, with Enoch, I did remember that there's this thing where it says, and then Enoch walks with God, and then God took him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do remember that because I think we were talking last week about Many Waters, and I just have this remembering of how in Many Waters they interpret that verse to be like, and then he doesn't die, he's best friends with gods, and then goes up into the sky on a pillar of light or something instead of dying.
Yeah. And I like the best friends with God sort of thing. Yeah. But yeah, following from our conversation before, it seems like Enoch only partied 365 times and God took him under their wing to teach him how to party correctly.
Great. Okay, next.
Right. So God repeats that decision from last time about blotting out the earth, this time to Noah. They say, make yourself an ark of wood, which my copy of the Bible translates as cypress.
Ooh, mine translates it as gopher and also notes that, like, we don't really know.
There we go. Okay, yeah. Meaning of Hebrew uncertain. So they just decided on cypress.
Yeah.
Anyway, and cover it with pitch. So the two of them make a covenant to make a covenant. The terms being, bring your nuclear family and theirs. Bring a reproducible two of every animal with you. And don't forget to take food for everyone, dingus.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Any questions?
Yeah, a little bit. So we'll come back to the big question about why is God doing this a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, okay, smaller one. This text emphasizes a bunch of times how much the animals have to come in twos and gives very specific directions about seven of the pure kind of animal and two of the impure kinds of animals. And so, one, why are some animals more valuable than others? And two, how are we feeling about the, like, you must bring two of every kind of animal because it is very important that they be in binaries?
So poorly from a human gender standpoint and positively from an animal husbandry standpoint. One thing that I want to point out is that this isn't the whole thing. The covenant is stated twice. Once the thing that I just said, Noah does some stuff. And then God says again, one, bring your household, not being specific about who comes along.
Right.
Two, bring several reproducible pairs of the clean and the birds, and one pair each of the unclean.
Mm-hmm.
And the third part, instead of saying, don't forget to take food, Hashem just says, it's coming, dingus! So, basically, I think this is not something that I studied the way that I did the earlier creation narratives, but it sounds like two different kinds of people were trying to tell two different stories.
Ooh.
And the latter story that was being told was, hey, in animal husbandry, it's very important to have a broad genetic base so that you don't get pugs.
That's a really good framing, and also a thing I'm thinking about in terms of, not to extrapolate this unduly, but you know how there are, like, genetic diseases that mostly Ashkenazi Jews have?
Oh, yes.
And it's because we all married each other, and we just aren't a very large, like, pool of us.
Yeah.
So maybe this is one of those things that's like, please remember to have enough of you so that you can have some genetic diversity.
Yeah. Also, Jazz, I'm so glad to have you as a 42nd cousin.
Oh my God.
I just want to put that out there.
We are not cousins.
No, I read a study back in like 2015 that was like, actually, all Ashkenazi Jews are at least 42nd cousins of each other.
That makes sense. Okay, yeah, sure.
Anyway, we're just continuing on. The House of Noah gets out only after the waters start. The narrative talks about, like, the skies open up, and then they're like, hey, we should get on the boat. They're fine, but everything else super dies, since even the high mountains are getting covered in water.
Mm-hmm.
We have 40 days of rain, 150 days of the water just chilling out, and then Hashem is like, wait, I forgot the dingus, and sets a wind to evaporate the water. The ark lands on a mountain as the waters start to recede, and then the waters continue to recede for another couple months. Noah waits 40 days after the waters have continued. It's confusing, but pretty straightforward also. Whatever.
We just have very specific timelines.
We do.
Great.
So he sends out some birds in waves, like sending them out, having them come back. And they eventually stop coming back, which he interprets as they found somewhere to chill out. It turns out the ground is starting to dry. Noah waits some more until it's super dry. And then Hashem is like, okay, once more with feeling, be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah.
Any questions?
Well, so about that last bit of the be fruitful and multiply, there is like a very normal bit and then a bit that I have questions about and then a bit that is very, very metal. When it says be fruitful and multiply, there's this sort of bit that echoes the creation story of the world will be given to you and like you can have all of it and eat any of it and do whatever. But unlike the creation one, it doesn't explicitly say, like, and you will rule over it or whatever. It just kind of says, it's in your hands now.
Yeah.
And so what do we think of this as a model? Like, is this more of a you're the master over it or more like it's your responsibility now?
So I think part of this is informed by the fact that Noah builds an altar, sacrifices samples from the clean and the birds, and God is just like, okay, we're not doing that again. Since we're starting over with the knowledge of good and evil already in humans, I'm just gonna let you go, just gonna keep having those seasons. And I think that's the best way you can do it, because even in a perfectly clean playground, as long as you have knowledge of good and evil, it's gonna be eaten at some time, is my perspective on that. Did that answer your question?
Well, no, but it was also an interesting thing. My question was, did in this phrasing, did God give Noah the earth as like a gift or as like a, now this is your problem to deal with since I've said that there's evil and it's just going to be there and I'm not going to destroy it anymore. But like, it's up to you now to figure out what to do with it.
So confession, I stopped reading during the sacrifice thing so that we could record. So I didn't actually get to the part where God is like, you deal with it now.
Great.
I give you everything. Bye.
I'm going to read this translation so that yes, our please. Listeners can know what I'm talking about. This bit says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And let the awe and dread of you be upon all the land animals and all the birds of the sky and all that creep on the ground and all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. And any small animal that is alive shall be food for you, like green grasses. I give you them all. Yeah. The next bit is
kosher slaughtering.
You have to do kosher slaughtering. And the next bit is like, if you kill other people, death penalty.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Not doing the Abel thing again.
Right. But so there is this bit that feels like now in our time of climate change, you know, where God has been like, well, I won't kill you all again, but the earth has been given into your hands. Like now you have to deal with it and people's evil and all of that. That's your problem.
Yeah.
And that happens right after the rainbow, right? No.
Before? The rainbow happens right after the, like, kosher slaughtering thing.
Ooh, tell us about rainbows.
Well, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. So the rainbow, which is the symbol of the gaze, is also the symbol of, you know, prepare for climate change and things might turn out vaguely okay.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know if that's the exact reading, but
this is like a side note, but did you know that there's a special blessing that's just for rainbows?
Excellent. Can you share? Or should I just Google this?
No, I got it. I'll read it for us. I pulled it up. It is Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Zocher Chabrit V'ne'eman Bivrito V'kayam B'ma'amro. Okay, nobody yell at me for my pronunciation.
You're so valid.
I'm trying to read it from the Hebrew, but basically...
Whoa!
You okay?
Oh, that's so cool. I thought that you were reading a transliteration very slowly. I'm so proud of you.
No, I'm working on reading things in the original Hebrew.
Yeah.
But it is a blessing that's basically blessing God who remembers, is faithful to, and fulfills the covenant made with Noah.
Nice.
Yeah, you can say it whenever you see a rainbow, which is a nice thing because theoretically, you could also do it upon, you know, rainbow flags and things, which, you know, whatever, who knows, arguably means that we are a fulfillment of a promise.
Aww.
Yeah.
Shucks. Thanks, Gilbert Baker.
But okay, there is this thing about rainbows and promises, and they're great.
Yeah.
this is not a text-based question, it's just a fun question, which is, if rainbows are like a symbol of promise, mm-hmm. what is a gay rainbow promise?
A gay rainbow promise is yes. I'm sorry, I don't have anything like deep about that. Maybe something about the healing power of queer love.
Aww.
And how, like, instead of a specific covenant of, like, we are different from each other on a fundamental level, it's like we have to hash out, we have to cut the covenant ourselves.
Ooh, that's fun.
And so, even though this wasn't intentional on Gilbert Baker's part, probably, the rainbow is a sign of the covenant between the gays.
Great.
And each other.
Great.
And also God. God's in there.
Sure. Why not?
So, moving on with the summary?
Yeah.
Okay. Noah is called a man of the soil. So, he's the first to plant a vineyard. And then he is also the first to take the grapes, make some wine, and get super drunk.
Yeah. He is really into dirt and really into wine.
Which, like, that's definitely a queer archetype.
Sure is.
Okay, so he passes out and Ham is like, hey, dad's naked. Can we like fix that? And then his brothers cover him and without looking at him, just like put him in a tent.
Yeah.
So Noah wakes up and is like, hey, you saw me naked, which I somehow know. So your son is cursed. He's going to be a slave to all his brothers. And hey, Shem and Japheth, thank you for covering me with a cloak and not looking at me. Your nephew, totally gonna work for you and all his descendants. So that's great.
Yeah, that's a lot. That story is a lot.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to say about this except that it's a lot, but I know we do have a listener question.
Yeah, from Nora.
From Nora. And Nora was basically like, what is up with that? I think actually quite literally.
What's up with the nudity or something?
Yeah, she said, what's the deal with all the drunk Noah stuff?
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is the deal?
I think this gets at kind of the thing that happened with Adam and Chava, where knowledge of good and evil included a sense of shame about nudity.
Mm.
And so, since the root of humanity starts out with that knowledge, there is already shame around nudity.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess on the one hand, it's like an emphasis that they're starting off with what Adam and Chava had to come into.
Hmm.
But also, I just hate this. Noah got drunk and he's being naked in public. But then he's laying the blame on his son and his grandson, which is just profoundly unfair. And I don't know, I had some stuff that I don't really want to get into here about, like, family nudity that messed me up.
Sure, yeah.
So just, like, having that onus placed on the one who sees instead of the one who's being exhibitionist is just bad. And the punishment does not fit with the transgression.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have particular thoughts on this?
So I tried to do a little bit of research on it. Not much because it is like a weird interlude and it makes me kind of uncomfortable, but I did try to do some. And also was thinking about that thing we were talking about earlier about how Noah is supposed to be like a really great dude.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this comes up a lot with our like biblical figures is that like these people are really wonderful and they do really terrible things.
Yeah.
And in this case, it doesn't feel like the terrible thing is nakedness. It feels like the terrible thing is cursing his son.
Fair.
So, but there's like a lot of euphemisms happening in this paragraph. And definitely some of the interpretations by like rabbis of the past was that like there's other stuff happening here that's not explicit in the text itself.
Okay.
That maybe it's not that the youngest son came in and just saw him, but that when it says he saw his nakedness, that actually it means he like did something terrible to him.
Okay.
Right? Like that there's other things happening, but we don't know that.
I think that gets at something at the core of Midrash, which is like you tell the story that you want to tell.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, but there is a little bit also a question of like, why is he drinking?
Mm-hmm.
And there are sort of different rabbinic theories. One of them is, like, the Earth just got obliterated. Like, maybe he just is having a really rough time.
Yep. Having a normal one, lads.
Right. Like, he's like, I don't know what to do with myself, so maybe, like, I just don't want to think about anything for a while.
Yeah.
And in that case, we're having a guy who's, like, really suffering through it, and he's like, I was really suffering, and my son came in, and instead of helping me or feeling bad for me, he was like, yo, did you see what's up with Dad? Isn't that funny? And then he lashes out.
Oh, that's a good reading. Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to say one more thing about this part before we move on. As the resident Christianity, quote, expert, end quote, I just wanted to mention that Christian theologians definitely use the curse of Ham as a justification for chattel slavery of people from Africa for centuries.
Oof.
And that this was, like, a good perspective. Good in, like, five sets of quotes, because no, it's objectively bad. Anyway, I have profound problems with this about, like, transgression and retribution.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we continue on with some genealogies. There's a mighty warrior. We just kind of skip over that. We've got some Babylonian cities that are being constructed.
Mm-hmm. And I think Egyptian ones, only because I see a passing reference over here to Mitzrayim, which is usually Egypt.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that, but the descendants of Ham are Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. We keep going, lots of people. And then we come to chapter 11.
And it's just sort of, and now for something completely different.
Right, yeah. So now the whole earth had one language and the same words. This is the story of Babel.
It sure is. And it's just like one paragraph tucked in at the end of this completely unrelated story.
So when we were originally planning the podcast and it was going to be a lot of, like, original fiction, you were particularly interested in writing about the story of Babel.
And I actually did do that. I think this is a time when we might have our first Patreon exclusive thing, because I did write one, which is a interpretive story about the story of Babel that I will make available to our patrons. You'll still have the regular episode, the rest of you, but, like, if you're interested in seeing what we were going to do, I actually really enjoyed this story.
Yeah. So are there any particular thoughts or questions that you have about this?
I have lots of them. Do you want to, in case one of our listeners has, like, never heard this story before, finish summarizing it?
Okay.
We have one language, and then what do people do?
People are coming from the west, and they come upon a plain and settle there. And they're like, hey, let's make bricks and, like, make sure that they're really good bricks. And with those, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we're just going to be scattered all over the earth. And then the Lord comes down and is like, hey, currently, they're one people with one language. And these are the same people who, within a generation, were murdering each other. So maybe I should make what they propose to do a little less possible for them. I'm going to go down and confuse their language there so that they will not understand one another's speech. And the Lord scattered them abroad all over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Yeah.
Yeah. The rest of the part is just more genealogy, but look, I love that there's genealogy everywhere, and I think that's a fun thing to talk about at some point, but we have a tower. Okay, the first question actually is, why are these stories in the same Parsha? That's my first question.
Welcome to the microfiction corner is the answer that I have to that.
Great. Welcome to the microfiction corner. So, okay, one theory I have here is that it's related to, like, what are different ways that God deals with evil things?
Fair.
And I have debates about whether these are evil things, but I like that God's like, well, in one of those cases, people are being bad and I will just destroy them. And on the other version, they're being bad, so I will, like, separate them from each other. Like children, instead of destroying them.
Keeping the promise. The rainbow promise.
So that's one thing. But my other thing about the story of Babel, okay, I was a linguistics student. right, we've been over this. The linguistics here are really suspect. Like, real bad linguistics.
Lots of back formations.
Yeah, there's a different podcast that I listen to that also, like, reads a book and then talks about it. It's not the Bible, it's just, like, a different book. And they have what they call a very fast linguistics corner, so I'm just going to insert a very fast linguistics corner. It's probably not true that we all had one language. There's, like, a number of different language families that exist, but also it implies that the only reason that everybody in the world can't work together is because they don't speak the same language, which is also not true. And also, it implies that if people were next to each other and spoke different languages, that they, like, couldn't communicate with each other, which mm-hmm. also is not true. Like, there's a bunch of languages that form by contact just because they're next to each other. Like, there is this thing going on here of, like, I'll just confuse their languages, and then because their languages are confused, they will scatter. And it's actually kind of the other way around. Like, we can't communicate with different people who are from different areas because mm-hmm. they're from different areas, and, like, languages evolve over distance and time.
Yeah, and this is, like, probably the wildest part of the Torah so far, honestly, in, like, how many fundamental misconceptions the story has about linguistics.
I enjoyed a lot. It's great. I also really, not on a, like, linguistic level, because it doesn't make any sense on a linguistic level, but on a, like, political level, I really, really enjoy the implication that if, like, we could just all speak the same language, we would all immediately be like, oh, yes, we are all working together now, and the thing we're working on is to overthrow authority.
We're all one race, the human race.
Yeah, talking microfiction, that's what I wrote about. Like, what if we did it again? Okay, we did it. We finished this parsha.
Yeah. Oh, one last thing, though. The parsha ends setting up the characters of Lot and Abram and Sarai.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's what we're going to be getting into next time. Yeah. I wonder, Abram and Sarai, those names sound vaguely familiar. What's up with that?
Vaguely familiar. Yeah. I love that there are cliffhangers. I forgot that there were cliffhangers at the end of all of these Torah portions.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect it because there are, like, five different episodes of the same anime in, like, one portion.
Yeah, okay, I love that there's cliffhangers.
So yes, you were talking about the rating.
It's time for our rating!
Heck yeah!
It's time for Rating God's Writing, the section where we rate how good we think this Torah portion is. Lulav, out of 40 days and 40 nights of rain, how good do you think this Torah portion is?
Okay. I'm going to say, 37 days and nights. Because it's actually very interesting, and there is some wild nonsense happening here. But also, the 3 days and nights that we're not getting into are just, like, the moral implications of a lot of these stories I am unsettled by.
Okay.
Jazz, out of 500 bricks which we have burned thoroughly, how many bricks burned thoroughly would you rate this parsha?
Oh, well, I would give it 470 bricks.
Okay.
And I would say that because I think that there's a lot of really, really cool things in this parsha. And I liked the stuff we were talking about the title. And I liked the sort of detailed elaboration. Like, we got all of the dimensions of how to build it and all of the things. And, like, there's really cool imagery happening here. And I love that. And I think it gave us a lot to grapple with. And I actually really appreciate the idea that, like, we're grappling with stuff from this one. Because Yeah, I do think there's a lot of big moral questions that it raises, and I don't know how to deal with all of those big moral questions, but I do think it can spark some really cool discussions, and I appreciate that, and I also really appreciate that it gave me an excuse to talk about linguistics again.
Thank you, friend.
Yeah.
So this is the time where we have audience questions.
Well, except we used our audience question earlier, which was bad planning on our part. So next time we'll put them here.
I have a tweet that I saw this morning.
Ooh.
So from @AsimArgari on Twitter, who is just like a mutual of mine.
Great.
Quotes from the Republican lunch bunch sitting directly behind me. The reason I'm not worried about climate change is that I really don't believe that God is going to take out humanity via natural disaster.
Ooh.
Do you have feelings on that?
Yeah.
I thought we could just discuss that a little.
I have lots of feelings thoughts on that? We just went over how, like, God gave us the earth, and it's our problem now. And maybe God's not going to take us out via natural disaster, but these are disasters that are human-created, and thus, they're our fault. Oh. So.
Oh, that's a good loophole.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's not always, like, the vaults of the heavens open up. Sometimes it's just, like, you did not correctly steward the gases in your environment, and it melted all the ice caps.
Yeah, and also, like, you were talking about that bit about animal husbandry, and it's a little bit similar to that idea of, okay, well, if you were like, well, God isn't gonna starve us, like, there will always be enough animals, and then you, like, don't bring on breeding pairs or whatever, like, no, that's your fault.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So, one big thought is, when I read this, before having read this actual Parsha, I was like, why wouldn't God take out humanity via natural disaster again? And then we got an answer to that. But I do like the workaround that you explained for that, which is that everything is in our hands.
I think so. I think
the other thing is just like, I cannot believe that somebody would be like, oh yeah, God's just gonna take care of it and I don't have to put in any work whatsoever on that.
Yeah, that's really super antithetical to, yeah.
Yeah. I have a one word reaction to this, and that's...
Okay.
Republicans.
Yeah. I'm assuming this person is a Christian and not a Jew, but I don't know this story. But it reminds me of the, I think, Hasidic story that I don't know the source for off the top of my head. But there is this thing that a rabbi told their student that God had a purpose for everything and for everyone. And the student was like, well, what's the purpose of atheists then? And...
Checkmate.
Right. He's like, sick burn on my teacher or whatever. And the teacher was like, well... The purpose of atheists is because if they don't believe in God and they do good anyway, then they're just like doing good for the sake of good. And when you see something bad happen, you should act like an atheist and assume that God isn't going to fix it and just you have to fix it.
Yeah.
And that's really fun. I also think it gives atheists like a little bit more credit. Like, I don't think that like all of the atheists in the world are like amazing people, but it's a fun story.
Listen. I was the vice president of two separate secular student alliances.
Amazing. I had no idea.
Really? Oh, okay. So, two things. I guess three things. One, I definitely remember that story from around that time. Number two is the people that I hung out with were like feminists. And a higher percentage of ethnic Jews than is found in the general population.
Uh-huh.
And three is, I definitely, in one of those organizations, the president was just like an ex-Christian who was really into Dawkins. And so my job was mainly like trying to steer club activities away from haha dunk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, you are right on multiple levels in basically everything you said there.
I feel like before we wrap up for the day, though, can we talk a little bit, like, moral implications about some of the stuff in here? Because I feel like we were angsty about it for a lot of this discussion, and
What particular moral implications do you want to talk about?
Well, like, how are we supposed to feel about this story that's basically God said, I will destroy everything, and then did destroy most things, and then felt bad about it, and also said, I guess I have to accept that you're just, like, created to have evil, as if God's also not supposed to have created humanity that way.
My reading is that, like, if you want things to happen, you have to expect that evil will be part of the happenings.
Ooh.
Like, there isn't an interesting world or a sustainable world in which nothing bad ever happens. And, like... Something that really helped to understand in, like, bringing me to the practice of Judaism instead of just, like, being ethnically Jewish is that, like, the Jewish God isn't omniscient, omnipotent, all of the things that Christians conceive of their God as generally. The Jewish God is just the one that created everything and the one that bends the arc of history towards justice.
Mm.
So, like, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, but at the same time, God's just the best that we have.
And we're allowed to argue with God.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is the best part.
Right. Like, and even in this story, the people just continue to be evil and continue to be rebellious. And it's sort of God coming to peace with that, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is real fun.
And, like, the reason that we choose to be the people of this God is that this God is a mutable one.
Mm.
Like, one who thinks about things the way that we as Jews think about things.
I like that.
I'm glad.
Okay. Thanks for listening to Kosher Queers. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. You can also follow us on Twitter at Kosher Queers, or like us on Facebook at Kosher Queers, or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album. They're great. Our sound production is done by my lovely co-host, Lulav Arnau.
What?
I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Lenape people.
I'm Lulav Arnau, and you can find me at SpaceTruck6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabeg.
We still don't have an outro properly, so have a lovely queer Jewish day.